Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Los Angeles-based veteran jazz drummer, percussionist, arranger, and composer, Matt Gordy. We had a long, good conversation on December 30th, 2021, getting it all in before the new 2022 year. We covered his long life in jazz and his first album in 20 years, the 2022 CD release of Be With Me. He has performed with international orchestras all over the world, from Boston to Venezuela, with the likes of Joni Mitchell, Tony Bennett, Frank Sinatra Jr., Aretha Franklin, Pete Frampton, Patti LaBelle, and Donna Summer. His collection of stories and witticisms are fascinating. Enjoy.
Yeah, we deal with improv here, man. Life happens, and we're in COVID, so like everything's going out the window.
I'm with you on that. Wow,
man. But Matt, man, I love the album. Thank you for taking a minute out. It's great to be able to talk to you here on Neon Jazz.
Sure, absolutely.
So Be With Me is coming out January 28th, and hopefully with the way the world's been since March of 2020, hopefully we're walking into a better situation here. The year's starting off, you got a new album. How do you feel about it?
I feel great, considering the last one was, 20 years ago. That's when I lived in Boston, and that album, you can actually still get that and check it out on Spotify. That's called Eclipse. And that was with my Boston band. That's 2001. That was recorded live at the Regatta Bar. So different circumstances. This album is obviously a studio album, which is a different set of circumstances. I tell you, right off the bat, I was so thrilled to have my college buddy, if you want to call him that, Alan Pasqua, to be on this project. You can tell I'm a geezer when I say I've known him for 50 years.
Wow.
You believe that? 1972, man. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me. You know, I was like 17 or 18 at the time.
I was born in 72, so I get it. I was just coming around.
Yeah, that's when I graduated high school. So, and I just entered in because I was at New England Conservatory of Music. That's where we were at school together. Laughingly call that, people call it NEC. We used to call it not exactly college. And today they call it, guess what? Not enough cash. But that's another subject. Anyway.
Yeah.
So does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely it does. Yeah. And I guess my question to you is, what do you ultimately hope the listener gets from this experience? I mean, everybody's perception of this is going to be different, but ultimately as the creator, what do you hope those that download or stream this get from this experience?
I hope that they can hear the love that's being poured out, and which is, you know, the language of jazz to me, because all the performances were heartfelt, absolutely. You know, we did it over 2 days. Interestingly enough, the title track, Be With Me, which is, by the way, based on Joni Mitchell's tune, A Case of You. So I had written a different, it's the same chords. I'd written a different melody, and a friend of mine, Greg Arthur, great singer, put lyrics to it. We did that in one take.
Wow.
Which just, I still can't believe it. And that was in July.
Wow.
I mean, really, you know, and I'm telling you, all the players on the album are great. I can't say enough about them. But to me, MVP is Alan Pasqua. I mean, just, oh my God, you know?
Yeah.
If I could play piano, because I also play piano, it's my first instrument, I would play like him.
That's a great compliment right there. I guess the one thing before we depart and get to your, you know, upbringing in Buffalo and kind of stay in the ever-present, the elephant in the room with our existence right now is that, especially for musicians, you know, the world's been turned upside down with the absence of live gigs and just the way everything's happened and transpired with COVID. And, you know, we've had time for self-reflection and to be in the quarantine and all of that. What have you learned about yourself over this time that maybe you didn't realize before that's going to make you stronger as you come out in January and promote a new album and hopefully start performing more out there?
That's actually a very good question. Because I, like many other artists, kind of went, you know, into the bunker, as it were, and with COVID, got more introspective and that sort of thing. Like, you know, what really have I done? You know, like why am I put on this earth almost to that extent, essentially? Because anytime you make a CD, any kind of recording, whether be it physical or digital or whatever, the first question everybody always asks me is, why would you make a CD? Nobody even owns a CD player today. Okay? And the irony of that is, if you want A, reviews, you know, Downbeat, Jazz Times, whatever, and radio play, guess what? You need an actual physical CD. Okay? Because those people do not do digital download. Some do, but majority do not. But so it basically comes down to, oh, so this is a vanity project then. And that's what I originally thought. So back and forth, but literally over the last 20 years, you know, should I do it? I don't know. I have a wood personnel. I don't know. Why am I doing it? You know, back and forth. And finally I said, you know what? I've got all this music in me, these arrangements, originals, whatever. I got to get them out there. It's not an ego thing for me at all. It's just, I have to say it, you know? And because a friend of mine has put it to me this way, you know what? Life is short. Art is long.
Yeah.
I took that to heart, you know, because, you know, there's all these other people out there and they're doing this and that. And, you know, me. And, you know, all you got to do is look on Facebook or anywhere you want to look, social media. And that's what it's all about. It's like, oh, here's my pride. Oh, I'm on the road with so-and-so. You know, I didn't really do this because, I mean, this band that you hear on the recording, I'll say 4/6 of the people, of the musicians there, we've been playing together for like, I don't know, 8 or 9 years since I moved out here in L.A. I've been out in L.A. 16 years now. So the X Factor was Alan Pasqua, who I literally had not played with, let's see, since school. No kidding. Okay? And he brought on board, who he's played with, Jeff Elwood, who he's played with for the last 5 years, let's say. So that was kind of the X factor of, you know, bringing all these folk together, and, you know. But everybody's a pro, so you just, you know, you send everybody the music, you show up at the studio, and you do it, you know, and you hope for the best. And I still have, it gives me chills still, believe it or not. And it's not just an ego thing listening to it, of, you know, aha moments, I would call them, where you just go, oh, you know, where you just, I get chills, you know, from what people played in the moment. Because don't forget, you know, it's jazz. We recorded this all live. There was a couple overdubs here and there to kick some clams in the horns, but it pretty much was just boom, you know, let's go. And also, interestingly enough, what a lot of people do when they record in the studio, because, again, this is over 2 days, the first day of recording, because it's 10 tunes, we did about 5 tunes, a couple takes of others. I came the next day, and people said, oh, did you listen to it, what we did yesterday? I went, no. They're like, what? Why would you? I don't want to be tainted by what I already played. I'm just forging ahead. Do you know what I mean? It's like, we'll see. Yeah. I'll have plenty of time to check it out later. You know?
It's the ultimate form of existentialism, almost. I mean, you know, you got to...
Absolutely.
You know, you got to take that line and you got to move it forward. And I think that's the interesting thing about how the jazz world works. And when this pandemic began, I remember thinking, if there was ever an art form out there that mimics what we're going through right now, it has to be what's happening with COVID. I mean, you all are thrown into an uncertain situation. You basically have one take, and you got to make the best out of it. And there's a lot of moving parts into it. And I think that's kind of the metaphor of this time here. Like, what are you doing? I mean, we're all, this whole pandemic's a monopoly. It didn't happen in one country. The entire globe is overtaken by it. What are you going to do?
Correct. Yep, that's right.
How did a kid from Buffalo grow up and become a musician in L.A. today? How did all this start and kind of transcend for you?
Well, actually, I was born in Buffalo, but I lived in a suburb outside, which is Tonawanda. And, you know, right next to Niagara Falls. So we used to make fun of my parents. We got to go to Niagara Falls again. You know, one of the wonders of the world. You know, so funny. But anyway, so background. My father's a doctor. My mother was a nurse. My father played piano a little bit and guitar and flute, believe it or not. My mother played nothing, but she had an unbelievable ear. So they said, hey, what's, you know, maybe he'd be interested in piano lessons. So I started piano lessons at 7, and I took from a teacher there, Miss Frank, for about probably 4 years, 4 or 5 years. Then in 65, we moved to Newton, Massachusetts, which is a suburb west of Boston. Did the regular, you know, elementary school, sixth grade, junior high, blah, 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 high school. But it actually in junior high, it kind of started because, you know, I was playing piano all this time, and I actually continued piano lessons in Newton at All Newton Music School. In ninth grade music class, Mr. Smith played Take Five, okay? Dave Brubeck, actually written by Paul Desmond. People think Dave Brubeck wrote it. He did not, nor does he take a piano solo on it. But anyway, but there is a big drum solo, which is like, God, must be 2 minutes long, easy, Joe Morello. And that was it. I'm like, I got to check this out, right? So I kept doing piano, but I switched to drums, taking, you know, official lessons, also in Paul Newton Music School. And I was fortunate enough to have a teacher, Mr. James Latimer, who is actually still alive, believe it or not. I've been fortunate my whole life to have, like, the best teachers of everything. Unbelievable. Started off on the snare drum, you know, here's your pad, which I didn't have. I had to play on my parents', you know, four-mic desktop because it had a good bounce, actually. And, you know, saved up my money. I was probably, at that point, 12. I kept playing piano, but I just kind of switched my focus to drums. And I saved all my money up, and I bought a snare drum and a hi-hat, okay? So I had that for about a year or so, and my grandmother's seeing this, and she's like, wow, I guess he's really into it. You know, he's taking lessons and blah, blah, blah. She bought me the rest of the drum set, which I still have today. It's a Ludwig 1967 Ringo Starr, you know, one of those. And I still have it kept in a friend's house in New Hampshire. You know, I started on my journey. So I started, you know, studying with this guy, Mr. Latimer. I remember the one day I went to the lesson, and he was playing by himself in the room with one of those Music Minus One records, right? And it was Take the A-Train, Duke Ellington. And I'm standing outside the door, and I'm like, oh my God, what is that? So I gently not come in, you know. I said, what the heck is that? He goes, oh man, this is a swing beat. And he wrote it out. And I love to see it. I still have the notebook today. He says something like, he wrote in the book, like, okay, here's a swing beat, ding, 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 hi-hat 2 and 4. And then the end, he says, at the end of a 4-bar or 8-bar phrase, you can do a little thing. Or not, you know. But this is time. You're playing the time. I'm like, okay. So that was started my journey into jazz with the drums, you know. So then, you know, a little time later, I started studying with Bill Wiley, who was a former Vic Firth student at New England Conservatory of Music. I would go down every Saturday and, you know, take lessons from him. And he encouraged me to apply to New England Conservatory, you know, as part of the bachelor program. And he totally, you know, tutored me and like, okay, this is what you need to play for the audition, because, yeah, you know, percussion, you get to play mallets, you know, marimba in this case, snare drum, and timpani, okay? Prepped all that up and, you know, finally went down there shitting bricks, I might say. One really cold, wintry storm in January, mid-January, to play for Vic Firth. Okay, people say, "Who's Vic Firth?" Well, he was the timpanist of the Boston Symphony, and he was actually the timpanist for 50 years, which is pretty amazing. Because think of any job for 50 years. But anyway, passed the audition, you know. But actually, interestingly enough, I applied as music education program, which was a 5-year program. So I kind of felt that they sort of would look the other way, so to speak, when you audition, because you're not doing it for performance per se. You're doing it for, you know, they're about how to teach other students. So, all right. So anyway, I'm in the school, and I was just in awe of, you know, because now you're going from a really, you know, pretty good high school, in this case, Newton North High School, to, you know, big fish in a small pond, to the opposite. So here's all these players that, you know, at the time, they played rings around me. And, you know, we're freshmen. And, you know, started practicing, my God, I think it was at least 8 hours a day. And I tell my students, they're like, oh, no, no. Oh, yeah, I did. For probably a year, you know. You know, did that. Interesting stories with Vic Firth, which I won't go into here. But so fast forward a little bit. Now I'd graduate, coming to graduation, and that would be June of 76. And one of Vic Firth's former students, his name was Tim Dolan, had come back to visit Vic and said, hey, you know, I'm playing this orchestra in South America, Maracaibo, Venezuela, which is the second largest city. I was playing percussion, principal percussion. I'm moving over to the timpani chair, so my job is open. And basically he said to Vic, you know, who wants this? Who wants this job? And at the time, there was only two of us graduating, and that was George Durkin and Neil Grover. And they didn't want to leave the country. So I'm like, shit, I'll go. I mean, it's a two-year contract. You know what I mean? It was equivalent to about $10,000 a year, you know, 40-week season, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I made a little audition tape, and then I, you know, drove to New York City and met the conductor, who actually had studied at Juilliard. His name was Eduardo Ron, R-A-H-N, who has since passed, obviously. But, you know, basically got the job on a silver platter, I might say, because he didn't even listen to the tape. He just went, well, you're a Vic Firth student. You must be the shit. So then I go to Venezuela, planning to stay, I don't know, 2 years, whatever, which is the basic contract. I ended up staying almost nine, okay?
Yeah.
And I started teaching there. This is in 78. I moved there New Year's Eve into 1977. Started teaching because part of the – originally I was there for principal percussion, and then consequently the timpanist Tim Dolan left, and I took his job about a year later. So part of that timpani job went with the contract was teaching. So I started teaching, that's what's called 1978. And actually that was part of today, which is called El Sistema, which is the system, which started in Venezuela. In fact, Gustavo Dudamel, conductor of LA Phil, is a product of that. And basically that program was government-sponsored, because I was a government employee, government-sponsored program. And what they would do is, you know, buy a whole bunch of instruments, and then go to these barrios, you know, poor kids, and say, okay, who wants to learn whatever, you know, clarinet, violin, drums, whatever it was. So I had about five students, I'll say, of, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, something like that. That was interesting to do, since my Spanish was not great. I knew hardly any Spanish moving there. So it was interesting to try to teach music in another language to get your point across with, you know, limited vocabulary and all that. But, you know, I managed to do it. Interestingly enough, one of the students I had, his name is Jefferson Pavajio, one of those quick study students, like, you just show, oh, you mean this? And, you know, boom, he just starts playing it. I taught him for 5 years, okay? And then he applied for a scholarship doing conservatory music. So he did go study with Vic Firth, and he won the scholarship, okay? So he went to NEC. I think he studied about 2 years, and the money ran out of the scholarship, and then he went back to Venezuela. Today, he is the timpanist of the orchestra. And the other percussion, the other students I had, Balbino Sanchez, and there was another one, they're in the percussion section of that orchestra. Because now, when I was there, it was maybe 100 musicians. I was one of 30 Americans. And the rest were Polish, Romanian, whatever. There were two Venezuelans in the whole orchestra. Okay? So today, of course, it's 100% Venezuelan, because my heart goes out to those people, because that country is, forget it. Okay? Mm-hmm. So anyway, so fast forward, so at, you know, almost 9 years, come back to Boston. Basically start all over, because as people know, in the freelance business, as musicians go, you always have to start at the bottom again. Even though I went to school there, all my colleagues and whatever were now playing in Boston Ballet and Pops and Boston Lyric Opera, et cetera. So, but I had to start all over again, which really sucked, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
So I'm going along in Boston. This is 1985. And about 2 years into it, I finally get a call to do, it was the contractor for Boston Ballet. And she says, Fred Buda, who was the timpanist of the ballet at the time, also contractor, has recommended you to play timpani for us. We're doing Prokofiev, Romeo and Juliet for 3 weeks, three-week run. Are you free? And I almost fell out of my chair because, I mean, wow. Okay? So I said, yeah, let me check my book. Duh. All right. Because what happened was the Boston Pops, which Fred Buda was a member, they were on a Japanese tour. They were going on a tour. So they basically had to hire three-quarters of the orchestra for Boston Ballet. So I was one of those. So now it's like the grandfather effect because all these organizations in Boston, Boston Ballet, Boston Lyric Opera, Boston Pops, Esplanade, whatever, I never auditioned for any of those, yet I played in all of them. How is that possible? Well, that one phone call, I am not joking, that one phone call put me back on the map in Boston. Because I literally hung up the phone, I said, boom, here's the audition. Now, of course, you got to go in, you got to nail it, right? You can't fuck around. Okay. I did it, and now, the contractor for Boston Lyric, who's sitting right in front of me in the pit, says, maybe you're available to do some subbing at Boston Lyric Opera. And now, boom. Because what happened was the principal percussionist, Richard Flanagan, who still remains today, principal of ballet and Boston Lyric Opera, would constantly be subbing out the opera because, again, it's all about the money. Because in Boston, as most major cities, there's a pay scale. Highest pay scale, Boston Symphony, Boston Pops, then Boston Ballet, then a lot lower than that, Boston Lyric Opera. So anytime that they get a call for symphony or whatever, they're gone. Okay, because I think it's union-wise, it's 49% of the contract. Anyway, so I literally subbed for him. Oh, my God. Imagine 14 years of Boston Lyric Opera. That's a lot of operas. Four operas a season. Unbelievable. You know, and I played timpani. I played percussion. What a thrill. What a thrill, you know. Fast now, we're finally getting to L.A. I know you're impatiently waiting. So finally, after all this, after doing a variety of, you know, star attraction gigs in Boston, you name it. The first one was Last Night of the Pips. That was a trip, playing percussion for that, playing vibes, and you're doing Midnight Train to Georgia, and you have to pinch yourself, oh, wait a minute, this isn't the cover tune, this is it, and she's singing it. I mean, it blew your mind. So anyway, that opened up the floodgates to do all these other star attractions, because as most musicians know, always comes down to the contractor, okay? So in Boston, I was on every contractor's list, and also in Connecticut, and also in Rhode Island, okay? Then I would find myself doing Aretha Franklin like six times, you know. Joni Mitchell, Both Sides Now tour when they came to Boston in 2000, I think it was. On and on, you know, Tony Bennett, Frank Sinatra Jr., Yes, Kansas, I mean, on and on, you know. Brian Wilson, oh, that was a trip. Because, you know, wow. I'm of the age of, I'm 67 now. So all those tunes like the Beach Boys did when I was in high school. Can you imagine being on stage with Brian Wilson? This is the sounds towards the deep.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And in order, wouldn't it be nice? Oh, my God. You know?
Yeah.
Moody Blues. Man. All that stuff. And you just can't believe it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that Brian Wilson thing, that was, I did that. I did it twice because I did it in Mohegan Sun, which is a casino there in Connecticut. The funny thing about that was somebody wrote a really shitty overture, I do not know why, in front of this whole, you know, Pet Sounds revisited tour. And it was terrible. I mean, because this is full orchestra. This is his band, seven, whatever, seven, eight musicians. plus a full orchestra. Okay, because they did that then. They had people had money, whatever. We're playing it in Connecticut, like about, it's a 10-minute overture, you know. I swear to God, 3 minutes into it, somebody stands up in the back and says, "This sucks, bring on Brian." So funny, you know, because it was true, absolutely
yeah.
true. You know. But then, so that was incredible. And just to be sharing the stage with these people, you name it, Donna Summer, Engelbert Humperdinck, Glenn Campbell, I mean, just the best of the business, you know. It was a trip. So anyway, Boston did all that. Then 2005, my wife, who at the time was working Boston Public Schools administrative, was laid off. And she decided, you know what, I'm sick of these New England winters after 20 years, blah, blah, blah. At the time, her daughter, my stepdaughter, was living in L.A. So she says, you know what, I'm out of here. So basically, you could say my wife left me for a minute there until I sort of came to my sense, because I could have stayed in Boston easily because I'm working. You know, it took me 20 years to build all this stuff up, right? So to be moving to a new city at 55 years old, not maybe the smartest idea, but back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Finally did it, you know, bit the bullet, 2006, put all the stuff in my van, drove out here, okay? I've been here 16 years now, so what else do you want to know?
Well, I want to tell you one thing, just because this was so seminal in your life and development of Paul Desmond. I don't know if you realize this, but I was at a Lonnie McFadden show here in Kansas City. He's a trumpeter, a tap dancer. He's probably the best entertainer in Kansas City. And some guy comes up on stage, and he's a career musician. He tells us the story, and I've heard it. It's corroborated. It's true. When Paul Desmond was on his deathbed, he owned the rights to Take Five, and he didn't have an heir to his fortune. And they specifically hashed out, what do you want to do with the proceeds from Take Five? And he's given it all to the American Red Cross. The Red Cross every single year rakes in thousands and thousands of dollars because of that one decision. So that's interesting. I didn't know if you knew that. But
no, I did not know that. But the interesting thing also about Take Five is, because that came out, it was like Time Out record, I'm going to say 64?
Yeah.
Ish, 64, 65. Check it out. I heard that not only in that ninth grade music class, but you could hear it on AM radio, okay,
yeah.
Which is unheard of. So whoever did the marketing for that tune, I swear to God, I've been in many, many countries in the world, you know, Buenos Aires, Argentina, Paris, France, England, whatever. The moment somebody discovers, you know, in talking, whatever, that you're a jazz musician, I swear to God, the next thing out of their mouth is, hey, do you know Take Five? I'm telling you,
yeah.
That is the serious marketing. It's unbelievable to me.
Oh, it's unreal. My precursor to getting into jazz radio, I used to listen to a show called Jazz in the Night by Dr. Mike, and his intro was Take Five. Anytime, when that came on, I was like,
nice.
Ah, 2 hours of beautiful jazz. And
nice.
I interviewed his son last Christmas, Chris, and it was
yeah.
when the outtakes came out. And he was telling me wondrous stories of Dave. Like, you know, when they were kids, his dad would be like, hey, he would kind of entice them to hang out and said, why don't you come on the road with me and you can carry my equipment. And I didn't realize this, but I guess Dave got into a swimming accident, dove into a pool and had chronic back issues for his whole life. And the kids would help. Yeah. So, I mean, but this is from his son, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, and then I just heard other stories too. That Dave was just like it didn't even factor in that he was famous. Like his son explained it to me, you know, he came from a poor background, but that was just never even anything on his radar. And people that worked with him would talk about how humble he was and how just a regular dude he was. So that just adds to the allure and the beauty of who he was as a human.
But I'm telling you something, whoever was in charge of his PR, it's amazing. I mean, seriously, think about that.
Yeah.
That's worldwide, my friend.
Oh. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean,
it's incredible.
I mean, just but the artwork and the approach and the whole thing, it was like he was the person of the year. It's like all of these things magically came together in some like jazz big bang thing. And it just exploded out and it will never stop. It's like Charlie Parker for Kansas City. Like, I still am just blown away that he is one of the most famous musicians ever. And I go down to 18 and Vine all the time. And I swim through these ghosts of him and all these people that were there for all those years. I mean, it's kind of done up, but it's dilapidated. But anyways, it's that Dave Brubeck thing. Like, what happened? Like, it's everywhere. It's all over the world. That's what people talk about.
Here's another thing. Here's a question for you. Name another tune of that, you know, 1964-65, or any time, really, that has a two-minute drum solo in it. Go ahead.
Oh, nothing. Nothing. Get out. Yeah, it isn't going to happen.
No.
That's the Trivial Pursuit question that we'll hear crickets. Yeah, I mean, it just isn't going to happen. Man alive.
And the other thing is, like I said, you know, Dave Brubeck, he doesn't take a solo.
Yeah.
He just plays his amp.
Uh-huh.
That's it. You know what I mean? It's unbelievable.
I mean, it's kind of like the kind of blues session. I was fortunate enough to interview Jimmy Cobb. And he was just like, we just play our buns off. That was his club exactly. That's all they did. They got into a room, and they just made something magical. Like, I don't know. It's weird, and it's the highest-selling album of all time. You know, and they had no idea, and that's just the way it is.
The thing, because I've actually seen written interviews, whatever, Bill Evans and other people that were involved in that. At the time, they didn't see it as like this monumental thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just another session, and you know, show up, da da da. Because nobody they didn't send music out before, of course. You know, you just show up, and okay, what do we got? Oh my God, there's only two chords here.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Miles probably got to a point in his life where he was like, stop fucking talking to me about it. You know, just like done.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
He had moved so far beyond that. But that just is another testament to his mastery of what he did.
Oh my God. Don't get me started with Miles, because, I mean, if you pick any decade, he always had the best band.
Yeah.
Okay. Pick any decade, it doesn't matter. The best band of the best musicians at the time. And it's, you know, and just kept constantly changing it and moving forward and, you know, and all that. It's just, it's incredible, you know, you think about that. And you know, he wasn't some poor kid out of St. Louis. You know, he was affluent family. His father was like a dentist or something, you know?
Uh-huh, yeah, yeah.
But the cat just had an ear, you know? I mean, it's just unbelievable.
You know, of all the people I've ever talked to that have always talked about him, you just wrapped up Miles. They always talk about the ear. Like, he listened like no one else on earth. Like, I heard stories. John McLaughlin one time was telling me about how he would pull everybody into a room and get a tape and put it in the tape deck, and he would look at that thing like he was looking at the suitcase from Pulp Fiction open up. And, like, he finally got to see what was inside of it, you know? There's Marcellus Wallace's soul. Like, he was just enraptured by what he was doing, and no one talked around him, or he would just say, you know, stop, and he would listen. And even in bands that they were in, they said that he would just sit there, and he would listen, and he wouldn't have a lot of expressions, but if you fucked up, he would look over at you, and that was it, you know? And it was because he had that ear. He knew how to orchestrate this intricate, like, machinery of jazz and music, and he just knew how to do it.
Because, I mean, that cat could hear grass grow. I am not kidding you, man. I mean, you've heard the stories, you know, like the Herbie, you know, when he plays like the wrong chord. You've heard that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Just, you're going along, it's just, he plays the wrong chord. It's just wrong in every way. And then the next thing Miles plays, all of a sudden it sounds right.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know how hard it is to do that?
Yeah.
I mean, come on, man.
Yeah. I can't even
And I don't
imagine.
Think he said much to anybody.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
He
wouldn't, like, spell shit out for you, you know?
No. He did
I mean,
not.
Again, that's what I call the Miles Davis School of Band Leading, because he hired those cats for a reason, okay? Because he heard something in their playing that this is going to gel. Now, we take a step back and say, why would you need, you know, Coltrane and Cannonball?
Yeah,
because they're like a what do you call it? A muse for each other. Like you know, they like egg each other on. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
That's man, that's serious genius. Because he didn't need two sax players, man.
No.
Coltrane was plenty, believe me.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Cannibal.
Yeah.
You know?
Without a doubt. Well, speaking of live music and magic, what was the first live show you ever saw that blew you away?
I don't know, because, you know, going, kind of coming of age in Boston, you know, I would go to this place called, this is before the jazz thing, but I was, you know, a minute into, like, rock and whatever. I used to go to the Boston Tea Party, and I saw Delaney and Bonnie, which people were like, who? Which were there, okay, but the kick it out. The opening act was the James Gang. And I just couldn't believe it, man. Here's Joe Walsh and, you know, hit the you know, stack of Marshalls, hits the chord, pulls the guitar up to the wall of Marshalls and feedback. I mean, just, you got to be kidding me, you know? But there was a lot of things then. I also saw Mahavishnu Orchestra for free. Boston Common, Billy Cobham, McLaughlin, those dudes, right? Oh, my God. Like, you know, here's Billy Cobham doing, like, push-ups, like, moments before he gets on stage. I mean, he was like Muscle Man. And he needed it because he had the most unbelievable single stroke in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And I bought that album, Intermounting Flame, which is, it came out about that time, early 70s. Unbelievable, you know. But then, you know, my parents also brought me to classical concerts. You know, I'd see Gilels, however you say his name, concert pianist. They always took me to, like, seem like the hippest shit, you know. And I was also fortunate because I think 66, my whole family, we took a vacation to London, England. I was probably 14 at the time. My brother was 16. And we went to the Marquee Club, dude. You can't even, I mean, you know, I saw Deep Purple. Remember that tune? Hush, hush, whatever it was.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Live. Furthermore, wow. I saw the Beatles' Yellow Submarine debut in London.
Wow.
Okay? So I come back and, you know, talking to kids in high, you know, high school and stuff, and they hear that Hush tune, like, oh, yeah, I saw that live. What?
That's beautiful, man.
But I had the hippest parents ever, man. You don't know. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's very cool. So, you know, you covered so much ground on your timeline here. I'm going to have a couple addendum questions here. One of them is, if you have a dream tonight, you run into your younger self. And you can give your younger self one piece of advice based on the wisdom you've got over all these years. And this isn't a regret question. This is about just your wisdom. What would you tell your younger self?
Take every gig. Worry about the details later. Which is true because, you know who told me that? Herb Pomeroy from Berkeley, you know, trumpet player, Boston. Because if you want to be a musician and – I don't care if it's classical shit, country, whatever, jazz, whatever. You need to play with others. I don't care what instrument you play, okay? Because you have to figure out how to, you know, walk across the minefield, as it were, or not, you know? Is give, you know, because every time you play with others, that's why in some sense I think, especially playing jazz, it's almost like a drug. In the sense that once you get a taste of that feeling of playing with others, let's say it could be a trio, doesn't matter, or a larger ensemble, and you have that instant communication with the musicians you're playing with, and you know what? There's no thought involved. At that point, hopefully, you're just playing on instinct, you know, of all the shit you've heard in your life. And now you're trying to, like, you know, have a conversation, you know, in context with others. And I'm telling you, the biggest advice I can tell anyone younger is, you know what? Wait, listen, and wait. And you say, what are you talking about? Because especially in jazz, and I think of drummers, you know, who do this. Do you know that drummer Phil constantly? It's starting to bug me now these days. I guess because I'm a curmudgeon and geezer or whatever. But I hear these younger drummers today who have chops up the yin-yang, okay? And they slice and dice the beat so much, you know what? There's nothing left, and there's no space either. How about, you know, we live in a this is a dichotomy world. I tell it makes me, what do you mean? Well, you can't have hills without valleys. You can't have light without darkness. And guess what? You can't have sound without silence. Now, it seems very obvious to say that, but you know what? A lot of people, and this is another thing I have to tell you, particularly with this album that I just love. People are you know, they're not afraid to just leave it, you know, space. You know, it's like Sid Roth said, man, space is the place.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay.
Yeah.
You don't have to, because you know, these drummers, it's like they never met a rest they couldn't fill. No, man. No. Let it go. You know, and I have these students, they're like, well, what's the fill there? That, forget the fill. Play the groove, man.
Yeah.
You know, the fill is icing on the cake, maybe. You know, what you got to do is listen to Steve Gadd, any of those cats. You know, it's about the groove. You don't want to buck the groove. You don't want to, you know, you got to stay in that pocket. Whatever the genre is. Again, we could be talking about country music, you know, and I'm not a huge fan, but there is good country music, okay? No doubt, you know? I mean, playing with Glenn Campbell, that guy was unbelievable, I got to tell you. And this is before he had, Parkinson's or dementia, I can't remember, towards the end there.
Yeah.
He couldn't remember anything. He just gone, okay? So this is prior to that. He was with his daughter on tour. Guess what they sang as a duet? Little Green Apples. Remember that one?
Wow. Yeah.
He did, check it out, MacArthur Park, the Jimmy Webb arrangement. Unbelievable.
Yeah. You know, everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your fans, but ultimately you live your life. You have a perception of you. Who do you think you are?
Now you sound like my shrink.
Yeah, see? That's what people say. I need to get the therapy chair out and just lay it down.
I need a couch, my friend.
Right.
I've done a lot of things in my life. Sometimes I feel like, did you ever see that movie by Woody Allen called Zelig? Where he basically takes on the persona. He's like a human chameleon. In some ways, I felt like I've lived my whole life like that, in the sense that, you know, I've been like this sort of fly on the wall, almost like, you know, in Forrest Gump, you know, he does all these things. And I feel like in some ways my life was like that as a musician. Because, you know, how many people can say that, A, they studied with Vic Firth, him for the Boston Symphony, Alan Dawson, Charlie Benakis, who was like the music guru in Boston for, you know, decades, died about 10 years ago. You know, to study with these people, explore, you know, because it's, I think myself, you know, I'm a nice guy, you know, that sort of thing. But I don't know. I mean, there's so much art to you know, in life to live, and to, whether it's painting or sculpture or music or whatever, is like, you know, the exploration is what we're trying to do here, you know. And that's one thing I have to say about music, because music, it's not finite. I mean, other professions, like, I mean, if I was going to study to be an engineer per se, you know, I'm sure there's a certain body of knowledge, right? It's finite, okay? There's certain rules you got to do, and this happens, and da, 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 da. Now, people could probably argue with me about that, but with the arts, especially to me with music, it's infinite, you know? I can't believe there's only 12 tones, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look how many combinations people have come up with, from Bach to, you know, Metallica. You know what I mean? It's quite amazing. So to me, it's the exploration. So it's almost like, if you have the ears, guess what? All this stuff is hidden in plain sight. The people that have the ears, and I'm telling you, I've met a lot of musicians, I can't believe the stuff that they can hear and execute on the fly. You know, one comes to mind was, I was fortunate enough to play with Rebecca Parris, the singer for about 14 years in Boston. And one of the, you know, she's various and sundry musicians, but one of them that just totally stood out to me was George Mesterhazy. Are you aware of him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He actually took over playing the piano for Shirley Horn before she passed. So you can imagine, why did she need a piano player? Well, she had diabetes, they cut her legs off. Sad. But that guy, not classically trained, okay? I always thought he was, because Rebecca would say, okay, here's this ballad, play an intro. And I swear he's playing like Prokofiev or something. I mean, it was unbelievable, you know?
Yeah.
Not classically trained. So anyway, so one story that sticks out to me was we're playing one time with Mark Murphy, the singer, at Scullers in Boston. Now, Mark Murphy, one of my favorite male singers, I got to tell you, that guy was incredible. When you perform with him, he would just start singing. He wouldn't play you the set list, nothing. He'd just start singing. So you have to first figure out the tune he's singing. And what key is that in? So we're on the gig. He starts singing Here's That Rainy Day. Well, guess what? Normally it's, I'd say probably in G. Most people play it in. He's singing in G flat. Okay. Does George care? He doesn't give a shit. Doesn't matter what key he's in, right? However, the bass player is like, oh, man, G flat, shit. He's scuffling, you know, going through this thing. And George, the professional that he was, is now it's coming around to the bass solo, and magically, it's in G. He did the sleight of hand. I don't even think Mark Murphy knew, okay, when he changed key. Because, I mean, it's a half step, you know, what's the big deal? But what a pro. You know, I think I was the only one that heard it. I look over at George and just kind of smile. I mean, who does that? You know what I mean? That's ears, my friend. What a force that guy was. I first played with him, in fact, with Rebecca. First gig I ever did with her, someplace out Western Mass. And I'll never forget that day. I'll tell you why. 1996, February, whatever, I want to say 26. Why is that day so memorable? It's the day that Alan Dawson died. Okay? So I was supposed to go to this gig with her, and it's, you know, a couple hours away. And I'm just about to leave, and Paul Broadnax calls me, you know, fellow Bostonian musician, and says, we lost him, just like that. And I went, oh, man. So, you know, you can't just, okay, thanks, bye, you know, and split. So I had to talk to him for like, you know, half an hour of, you know, that stuff. So if people know me, I'm never, ever, ever late for a gig, okay? Now I'm like half an hour late, 20 minutes to half an hour late, right? So I finally get to the gig. I see Rebecca. And I just, you know, I never played with her. And she says, what's going on? I said, we lost AD. And she just started crying, you know, because we all knew him, you know. And George was there, and Mike Monaghan and others. And we just said, you know what, let's dedicate this to him. And so it was a memorable gig on a lot of different levels. Man, AD was the shit. Unbelievable. I mean, I only studied with him basically one summer. Note to self, never study with Alan Dawson and Charlie Benakis at the same time. Because, you know, piano and drums, right?
Yeah.
I was practicing, I'm not joking, 4 hours of piano, 4 hours of drums a day, okay? And, oh, my God, it just, and I regretted one of the weeks I was going, because I was going to Dawson's house. He lived in Lexington because he stopped teaching at Berkeley. I was so regretting going to that lesson that day, oh, my God, because I knew I hadn't prepared enough. And interestingly enough, which is another story I talk about, between the difference of teaching, let's say, between Vic Firth, symphony guy, and Alan Dawson, jazz drummer. Which one do you think was more demanding? You
probably
would probably
Alan.
Think the symphony guy, right?
Yeah.
Wrong! Because here's the difference, right? I'll tell you two quick stories. When I studied, first going to an NEC, and, you know, studying with Vic Firth, about the second, you know, here's freshman year, second or third lesson in, I'm doing snare drum and mallets, because you don't even get the timpani until you get to sophomore year. I'm doing the snare drum thing, whatever. And I'm no joke, I was practicing 8 hours a day. I'm not exaggerating at all. So I go in there, feeling, you know, I feel pretty good about it. In the middle of the lesson, Vic puts down the sticks and goes, what have you been doing all week, picking your nose? And I thought he was kidding. I'm like, he ain't laughing, buddy. Okay? And the whole lesson was this Paul, P-A-L-L, over the whole thing. You know, and I'm like, oh, my God. So I walked out of there thinking, you know what? This is me now. I guess I better do 10 hours a day. Okay?
Yeah.
Guess what? I found out years later he did that to everyone just to see your reaction. Guess what? One of my fellow colleagues who came in as a freshman, John Boulder, he quit. And I'm like, dude, he's just asking you to step up. You got into school. What are you doing? No, man, it's too much pressure. Holy shit. So that's that story. When I stayed with Dawson, same thing. I'm dreading this lesson. I get there. You know, I'm like, oh, boy, this is going to plan the thing. Puts the sticks down. And he says, now, let me understand something. You're Matt Gordy. Is that correct? I said, yeah. Now, let me just make it clear. I want to understand this. Your name is Matt Gordy. Is that correct? He said it, Joe, like 10 times.
Yeah.
And every time he said it, I felt like I dropped off the back end of the dog. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He never said, you didn't practice, you suck, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. That's all he said. He shamed me like he put a mirror up to me. You know what I mean? And I just couldn't believe it. One of the gigs I did with him, I called him out of the blue and I said, because there was a club in Boston at that time called the Willow Jazz Club in Somerville. It was kind of the local jazz club, whatever. So I call him and say, hey, man, we should do a gig together. He says, okay, what do you want to do? I said, well, when I play drums, you play vibes. And when you play drums, I'll play piano. And we hired a guitar player and a bass player. I love this. He goes, yes, and we will show the versatility of the percussionist.
I miss that guy, man. Awesome.
He was such a gentleman, if you ever met him. Unbelievable.
Yeah. That's wonderful, man.
One time he told me in the lessons, he says, hey, you know that symbol that Tony Williams uses? I said, yeah, the one that's like his signature. He goes, yeah, I gave him that. He said, it wasn't for me. I went,
wow.
Holy shit. I mean, like, yeah. When you hear two beats on any of those Mars records, it's Tony. It's the symbol. You know what I mean? That's his sound.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't for Alan. He gave it to him, you know?
Wow. Wow.
That's heavy, Ben.
That is heavy. That is heavy. So, Matt, I totally appreciate the time. This has been illuminating and wonderful. Thank you for taking time out. Good luck with the album and everything as we move forward in this weird world.
Yeah, man. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in Los Angeles, Boston, New York City, Lee Summit, Missouri, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Matt for his time, energy, and cool. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.